From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
I'm Leonard Lopate. Welcome back to my show. Nobody's ever met the CEO, and the company's mission statement is all but incomprehensible. In fact, none of the employees at Zephyr Holdings really understands what the company does. Zephyr is at the center of Max Barry's satirical new novel called Company. It's published by Random House. And his previous novel, Jennifer Government, was a New York Times notable book. Also, a spin-off of it was made into a popular online role-playing game. I'm very pleased all of that brings Mr. Barry to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You say that research for this new book consisted of doing unrelated things in the hope that something would happen that I could use in the book. What
right,
sorts of unrelated things?
That's my claim to do research for my book. I tend to write about companies, and although I draw on my own experience of having worked for a big company some years ago, doing research for books for me is mostly just hoping that I see something that triggers something in my brain, and then I think, oh, maybe I can use that at some point.
Did people start writing to you after the previous book, Jennifer Government, and send you ideas that you could use in this?
Not so much ideas. I do find, because my two previous novels, Jennifer Government, as you mentioned, and Syrup, are both about satirizing marketing and satirizing the corporatization of society, that I try to find the humor in these things by stretching trends that I see to the absolute ludicrous extreme. And, for example, in Syrup, the characters are engaged in making a movie that is essentially an advertisement. You want to get people paying their $6.50 or whatever to actually see an ad. So things like this that I tried to make as extreme as possible, I had trouble staying ahead of reality, really, because I would have the book published and then very quickly these things would start coming true. So I do find that I get people emailing me to tell me, oh yeah, I saw something just like this the other day.
So you start off with the idea that you're writing something that's a metaphor for what happens in the real world and then discover that it actually is a lot more realistic.
Well, with marketing, yeah, I do find it's very hard to stay ahead of the marketers because as ridiculous as the ideas that I can think of, they can go one further. And this was actually, there was an amazing event with this, with Jennifer Government, where that book is set in a kind of near future where the world is ultra-capitalist and ultra-libertarian. The government is privatized, and the reason it's called Jennifer Government is because people take the surnames of their employer. So Jennifer works for this crumbling government that needs to try to raise funds before they can pursue criminals. But yeah, the book kicks off with a marketing manager at Nike deciding that he's got this great idea for how to promote a new brand of sneakers. And he's going to hype the hell out of it, but he's going to only release a few hundred pairs onto the market to really build demand. And there's an opening scene where people are basically attacking each other outside this Nike Town store for sneakers. So the book was published a couple of years go by, and then there's this riot outside a Nike Town in New York. It was this Nike Pigeons, I think they were called, where very limited release, only a couple of hundred pairs sold, and then people beat each other up for them, basically, and then sold them for thousands of dollars on eBay.
They must have read your novel.
I felt very smart where that had happened.
Well, you worked for Hewlett-Packard while you were writing Syrup, the first novel. Did you see that job as a research assignment, or did you think that that was what your career might be at the time?
Well, I saw it as the basis for a book right from the get-go, really. It was amazing to me. I had always wanted to be a writer, but I knew that I wasn't going to be able to finish high school and suddenly become a full-time writer unless I was living in the streets and begging for money. So I thought I would go into advertising, which seemed to combine a bit of the creative and a bit of the analytical, which I was interested in. And that was my first exposure to marketing. I remember just being amazed by the sort of things they taught us in this course. One of the things was the just noticeable difference theory, where it's this official theory as part of the body of work of marketing theory, that the exact amount that you can shrink, say, a candy bar by before anyone notices it's actually smaller. And so the companies can shrink it and keep the price the same, of course, and then either give you 10% free and put it back to the original size or whatever. So I did this course, and then I went to work for HP, which was my first exposure to a big company, big American company. And it had a very strong culture, which was invented in Cupertino, California, and then exported to all the regional offices all over the world. So no matter where you are working for HP anywhere in the world, it's all the same.
And you were doing this in Australia?
I was doing this in Melbourne, Australia, that's right. And I remember it was kind of a shock to me, as naive as I was, that until that point, life had been about broadening my horizons and becoming an educated, well-rounded member of society. And then I go to work for this company in the sales team, and they're not interested in how well-rounded I am. They're interested in how well I can fulfill my sales quota. So it was just a little thing like that. And also the idea that the company itself was a little self-contained world with its own rules about what was right and what was wrong. From the social through to the legal. And it was just amazing that it was such an interesting dynamic, I felt. You have all these people going to work, and as a human being, as an employee, it's a really important part of your life. You spend half your waking life at your work. You have a social order there. It's really like a family. Whereas if you're a company or you're running a company, then you're only really employing people because that is necessary for you to achieve your financial goals. You have to provide a semi-enjoyable workplace for people to get them to show up, but that's not your objective.
The protagonist of this novel, Stephen Jones, is creative and curious. And obviously that was semi-autobiographical. He's referred only by his last name in the company.
Yeah, he loses his first name when he joins the company. He actually, starts out as Stephen Jones, but the company, for reasons it's difficult to reveal without giving away too much of the plot. But,
and I don't want to give away the
thank you very much.
Surprise.
Yeah, I'm always nervous about that. It's I have this, really, page 101 in the book reveals what the book is really about. And so I'm always nervous that people find out about that first. So the company refers to him simply as Jones, so he does lose his first name when he goes into the company.
The employees who work at Zephyr don't really understand what the company does. Do you think that ever happens in the real corporate world?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do try to push this a little bit than it is in real life, but as we were talking about earlier, sometimes it's hard to stay ahead of real life in this respect. Certainly, in a big company, a lot of people will understand very well what they do and what their department does, but feel very disconnected from what the company does as a whole.
Well, one of the characters in Company, Roger, spends most of his time looking for the coworker who stole his morning donut.
Yes.
And he winds up coming to lead his own department. So obviously he's doing his job well.
Right. This was something that I experienced at HP. It was one of those little incidents that is very hard to understand outside the company. If you were standing outside and looking in, it would make no sense whatsoever. But inside the company, it was very, very important. And donuts were this mid-morning snack we would get once a week. That we would get mid-morning snacks every day, but donuts were the special one. Every other days, it was fruit and cookies and less desirable snacks. So everyone would make sure that they were around when the donuts were served up on Tuesdays, and we would raid other departments for their donuts, and it was very important.
And hence the picture on the cover of the American edition of the book. I don't know if it's on the other editions. A huge donut with a bite out of it. The book is Company from Max Barry, and it is published by Random House. Well, the senior management at Zephyr devotes much of its energies to downsizing and cutting costs and then rewarding themselves. Now, this is totally unrealistic.
Right. How do I come up with this stuff? Yeah, it was. I find it really interesting, the idea that you have so many corporate scandals involving people who basically turn out to be cheats running the company. And you could write off a few of these as just coincidence.
Have you been following the Enron story?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And it's not just Enron. I mean, Enron is the most visible of the corporate scandals, but they happen all over the world to many, many large companies. And at some point you have to think, you know, it's not just coincidence that these guys are getting done. There is something in the structure of the corporation that rewards that type of personality, that lets that sort of person rise up to the ranks of senior management.
The funniest part is that none of the senior managers have ever met Zephyr's CEO, but they would never admit it to each other. Because if you let people think that you are one of the ones who's met him, then you're more important.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of these little things that don't make sense within the company, but people tend not to think about them very much. And in the novel, Stephen Jones goes to work for the company, and these things start to bother him. His co-workers will tell him, this is just the way things are done here. It's not a big deal. Get used to it. But he has to find out what's going on. So he starts investigating. And as I won't reveal, but he finds out that these things do actually make sense if you know what's really going on in this company.
Human resources, for example, how do they respond to pregnant employees without appearing to be discriminatory?
Right. Human resources is, I just find that whole phrase quite creepy. It's, you know, it's, we are all used to it, so we don't think about it. But I mean, really, human resources, that's a very strange idea to me, that you look at humans as resources. In the book, they, of course, can't discriminate against pregnant employees. But at the same time, they're aware that an employee who becomes pregnant will become less productive. They will engage in less work. And when they've had a kid, they'll want to take more time off. I mean, the most productive employees in a big company tend to be people who are very driven, tend to be single, and they get to spend, they have the opportunity to spend lots of time, overtime working for the company. So human resources will, in the book, is confronted with an employee who they suspect is pregnant and do everything other than blatantly discriminate against her.
Freddie applies for disability pay on the basis of stupidity.
Yeah, I've
always wondered about whether that could be pulled off.
Right, yeah. His theory is that if you are born stupid, then there's nothing you can do about it. So surely the company can't discriminate against you for that.
Now, I get the sense that corporations are the same around the world, that Australia is the same as the United States. But you chose to locate Zephyr Holdings in Seattle.
Yes, I did.
Because it's such a nice town.
Well, I mean, for a long time, this book wasn't set anywhere in particular. It was indeed meant to be a story about corporations in general. And when I worked for HP in Melbourne, as I said, there was very little to distinguish that from the Cupertino office or the office in London or anywhere else, because this culture is dreamed up in headquarters and then exported all around the world. I decided that I did have to set it somewhere eventually, because I wanted the characters to get outside the company a bit more and for various reasons like that. And pick Seattle mainly because the last time I was there on book tour for Jennifer Government, I took some photos of the city. And I was going through these photos later and noticed this very tall, very ugly building that looked almost like a prison, but a prison for white-collar workers. And I thought, oh, this is my building. This is the place where this story takes place.
Well, you have a website called Tales of Corporate Oppression, where people actually tell their horror stories. But tell me a bit, in the few moments we have left, about Nation States. It's a game that you created out of your last novel.
Yes. Yeah. Well, based on similar ideas about what sort of worlds it might be if we all got to run our individual countries the way that we thought they should be run, because people have wildly different ideas about that. It was a little game I wrote. So I had no real programming experience, but I thought it would be kind of cool to create this little game. And I just bought a book on how to program. I created the game, which is now at nationstates.net, and put it up there. And totally, to my surprise, hundreds of thousands of people thought it was kind of cool. And
so one person, all just word of mouth?
Absolutely. I sent an email to 20 friends, and they told their friends about it. And basically, the number of players doubled every day for about the first 6 months.
Well, how much work do you have to do to maintain this? You even have a Nation States encyclopedia and a fact book.
Yeah, there
is.
Are
you kind of trapped?
A little bit, yeah. My theory was I would put this game up and then I would just leave it, you know, because it's a website. I don't have to do anything. But when there were 100,000 players and all of them were demanding new features and new things to be fixed, then it started to suck me in a little bit. So I do have now a team of people, volunteers, who just love the game and help out with running it. But yeah, I haven't managed to completely get myself out of that website yet.
Well, there is another side. You could just create your own corporation. One of my favorite corporations from the players, Nation States, is the Imperial Corporate Republic of Neo-Industria, which has a motto, World Domination for a Better Tomorrow.
Right, yeah. People create the coolest nations. It's just so funny to go through.
The paradoxical republic of peace-loving warlords. Life is sacred until we destroy it.
Right.
Anyway, yeah. This book, I'm sorry, I'm finish what you were going to say.
Yeah, no, I feel very proud that I managed to create this site, and it's a very simple little idea, and then all these people showed up and turned it into a real community and created these very funny, very satiric nations, and it's become the very vibrant place it is today.
Meanwhile, we have Company, Max Barry's latest novel, published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
And Max Barry will be speaking tonight at 8 p.m. at Rocky Sullivan's, which is located at 129 Lexington Avenue between 28th and 29th Streets. For more information, you can visit our website at WNYC.org. Up next, we will find out how radical strip mining is changing the face of the mountains of Appalachia. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820 and WNYC.org, the place for news and talk all day, classical music all night. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard LoPate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.